This is the Oral Talmud, Episode 7, No More Gatekeeping. Welcome to the Oral Talmud, a co-production of Judaism Unbound and Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Vinay Laffey.
The Oral Talmud is our weekly deep dive study partnership in which we try to figure out how voices from the Talmud, voices from 1500 to 2000 years ago, can help us think in new ways about Judaism today. After our interview with Talmud professor Barry Wimpheimer last week, we're back to the text with another foundational Talmudic narrative, the story of a conflict between two early sages, Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yehoshua, or Rabbi Joshua, and what happened to the early center of reimagining Judaism, a place called Yavne, after Rabban Gamliel was deposed from his position as the nasi, or leader. We'll go over the details of what's going on in the lead-up to this story, and once we reach the text itself, you'll see we find there's so much to discuss about every half-sentence that we're going to be moving through the story at a pretty slow pace. We're going deep here. There are a lot of interesting connections to make to college admissions and some things that we could only see because of where we were in the COVID-19 pandemic when we recorded this, which offers some support to the idea that we can see different things in the text at different times of history, of life, and maybe even of the day. This story is about literal gatekeeping, and we make some important connections between the story and the gatekeeping still starkly present in Jewish communities and rabbinical schools today. In discussing this story, we also draw from our conversations about the subtexts and historical layers of Talmud, which David Kramer and Barry Wimpheimer brought to us, as we consider the mythologizing going on in the text. Wondering if this story was perhaps actually the product of later Talmudic rabbis writing about their predecessors in order to process what was happening in their own time. This is part one of our dive into this story, so we hope you'll join us again next week as we continue the narrative. Each episode of the Oral Talmud has a source sheet linked in the show notes on a website called Sepharia, where you can find pretty much any Jewish text in the original and in translation. If you wish, you can follow along with the texts we discuss and share them with your study partners, or just listen to our conversation. And now, the Oral Talmud. Hi, everybody. This is Dan Liebenson, and I am here with another episode of The Oral Talmud with B'nai Lappi. Hey, B'nai.
Hey.
And we are really excited to dive into a really important story that's meaningful to both of us, I think, for the same reasons, for different reasons. And so it's a story that I think we both initially think of as a short story, and it turns out that there are layers upon layers, as should not surprise anybody. And so the text that we want to jump into today is from the tractate Brachot. This is thought of as the first tractate in the Talmud in the sense that it's traditionally the first one that people study.
Right.
But I don't know. Is it right to think about the Talmud in any way as really having a beginning?
I don't think so. Every single page of Talmud, including the very first page of Brachot, which, as you say, is usually volume Aleph on your shelf and the first one you start with in a Daf Yomi cycle, or every single page presumes you already know every other page. So I don't really think there's a beginning or an end.
But so for what it's worth, this is page 28a, and although the part that the backstory kind of starts at 27b, just to remind people who don't know that the Talmud counts pages by folios, meaning both sides of the page are counted as page 28. And so there's side A and side B. This is pretty early on. If somebody does start studying the Talmud traditionally, this is relatively early on. And, you know, what's interesting to me is, like, I wonder what is made of it in some of the more traditional circles, or maybe they just skip it over because there's certainly radical potential in this text that'll be fun to explore.
You know, as you mentioned, radical potential. As I sort of check in with my more quote-unquote traditionally trained rabbinic colleagues, and I ask them, what do you make of this? How can you possibly read this story without the radical, or this story, or that's pretty much every story in the Talmud or every passage? I think the fault line is that in some communities, the radical is acknowledged, but it's like, oh, they could do that, but we can't. And I think that the difference between sort of, as far as Svara goes, or my philosophy goes, the us and them is, yeah, look at the radical, and they meant us to receive that story so that we would do that as well. And
right.
It's a large issue of trust of one generation to the next, but I digress.
Well, that's certainly, so there's certainly a lot to unpack here. So let's jump into it. Just to give a little bit of background on some of the characters here. These are characters that we've talked about before. I think that, I don't know that we completely did this intentionally, but there is this kind of group of characters later and maybe at another time. I want to actually start to explore them as kind of the Knights of the Round Table of the Talmud, because they're kind of this particular cast of characters that are kind of recurring cast that a lot of stories are about. There are stories about other later characters, but this is the crew. This is the people that are really remembered. And I don't know if that's because they were in the early days or because they were in that chaotic middle period. And by the way, I think so. Those are the times that people remember: the wilderness and the Torah and the Yavne period in the Talmud. And it's interesting to think about these particular characters. But the main stars of this show are Rabban Gamliel, who is the kind of head rabbi of these early days of...
He's the president. You're right. These are they're the brat pack of the rabbis.
Right. But also kind of you say, the cabinet. He's the president.
He is the president. I mean, they call him president. You have to wonder. I don't know. I love their chutzpah at giving themselves and each other titles that are so important. But anyway, they called him Nasi, which means president.
President. In modern Hebrew, it means president. At that time, I think it had more of a valence of a prince, which, may be the same concept. But it's actually really hard to translate. I translated, as we've talked about before, I translated the novel by Yochi Brandes, an Israeli novelist, called The Orchard in Hebrew, The Orchard of Rabbi Akiva. And actually, it was really hard to translate this term, Nasi, because if you translate it as prince, the English reader would be like, there was a prince, who was the king, And if you translate it as president, that sounded too contemporary. And initially, I translated it as leader, but then it didn't work because there were some things that happened later where you actually had to have the word Nasi. So eventually, I think I translated and explained it the first time as leader, and then the rest of the time just didn't translate it.
You just left it
as the name of an office, Nasi. But he's the head guy. And this is a story about that time when he was impeached and removed from office. He didn't apparently have, Jay Sekulow and various, Mitch McConnell on his side. That's an interesting point in of itself, right? Where was his Mitch McConnell? Why was he removed? Well, maybe we can get into some of that. Yeah. But there's him, and then there's...
Sorry to interrupt you, but now that I think about it, if we remember the story that we told a couple weeks ago, the Oven of Achnai story, he and Rabbi Yehoshua are on the same team.
Right.
As we're about to see, they end up on different teams. Maybe Rabbi Yehoshua was as Mitch McConnell and he jumped parties. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. Or I don't know, is it, if somebody out there knows this, or if you know it, B'nai, but or is there even a sensible question, but is there a way to know whether the Oven of Achnai story happens before this or after this?
It has to happen after this, because as we know, the end of the Oven of Achnai story, Rabban Gamliel dies. So.
Oh, right. So in that case, what's interesting is to imagine that maybe this actually story is when Rabban Gamliel switches teams, because in the earlier story, and in this, the beginning of this story, he's kind of against Rabbi Yehoshua, but by the Oven of Achnai story, he's on Rabbi Yehoshua's team.
Yeah,
so maybe this is really that switch.
Yeah, I would see it the other way. I would see that Rabbi Yehoshua joins Rabban Gamliel's team. I mean, Rabban Gamliel's, he's the head guy. And I think once this episode of today's story is over, Rabbi Yehoshua and he make peace again and are on the same side.
This will actually be something interesting to track, which neither of us, I think, was quite, it's interesting how these conversations go. This isn't where we were planning to go. But as I talk it through, I'm like, wait a second, this is an important question. This is actually a turning point. And I don't know who, it's an interesting question, who switches to whose team and how does that matter? And, what does that mean? I would say just as a starting point that in this period, Rabban Gamliel is kind of, he's a more conservative guy. He comes from the family of Hillel, which is, on the one hand, kind of a more progressive strain of Judaism, but he's kind of a tough guy. He seems more conservative, in his orientation. And Rabbi Eliezer is the more conservative of the Rabbi Eliezer versus Rabbi Yehoshua kind of rivalry. And so it kind of makes sense in a way. It makes more sense to imagine Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer being kind of on the same team. And so the idea that Rabban Gamliel switches to the more progressive side is the reason I raise it is because I think that it potentially has valences for our times. Can we imagine the guy that's more like Rabban Gamliel in the world, I don't know who that would be today. I mean, in the Jewish world, having a wake up moment and saying, you know what, we actually really are at a bigger transformation than I thought. And maybe I should team up with the more progressives. Maybe I just
exactly.
Want that.
I think that's the moment. We should come back to that.
So basically, this is the story of the time that Rabban Gamliel was removed. And he was removed because he had a fight with Rabbi Yehoshua. I want to jump into the text, but I also want to make sure that people have some context. So let's just quickly talk about a little bit of the context, which we can find on page 27b of the Tractate Brachot, which is basically just describing why was he removed from, like, what was his crime? What was his corruption? You know, what did he do to deserve being thrown out?
The articles of impeachment.
Right, the articles of impeachment. And basically the articles of impeachment were, I mean, the most obvious that's from the story here, that he was mean to Rabbi Joshua. And by the way, like, one should note just that that was actually kind of when James Comey was fired, right? That was what the excuse for getting rid of him was that he had been mean to Hillary Clinton, which was obviously a pretext. And maybe that's a pretext here too. But the pretextual reason for getting rid of him, at least, is that he was mean to Rabbi Joshua. You want to say more?
Yeah, this last story is the last in a series of at least three episodes with Rabbi Yehoshua, with the same guy, where he was, at least the rabbis understand him to have been unnecessarily cruel, shaming, demeaning. You know, there's the famous story where Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabban Gamliel disagree about how the calendar is calculated. And based on their different calculations, Rabbi Yehoshua ends up with Yom Kippur being on day X, and Rabban Gamliel ends up with Yom Kippur being the next day or the day before. I forget the exact details. And Rabban Gamliel says to him, okay, Yom Kippur is going to not only be on the day that I say it is, but because you are publicly disputing with me, I command you to come to me carrying your staff and a bag of money and a cheeseburger.
Right. Meaning I command you to violate Yom Kippur.
On the day that you think Yom Kippur is. So did he really need to do that? And Rabbi Yehoshua eventually does it. But there's this kind of overbearing, authoritative, demeaning cruelty. I mean, real cruelty. And this story that you're about to describe is the last of a series of these episodes with Rabbi Yehoshua.
So yeah, so it's not only that they had a dispute, it's that Rabban Gamliel is extremely cruel to Rabbi Yehoshua, who is apparently a beloved person in the community. And instead of having a dispute and saying, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm the president, I decide whatever, you know, I'm the decider. Instead, he's needlessly cruel to him. And so he, instead of just saying, like, I'm deciding and it's going to be this way, he forces him to come on Yom Kippur to violate the day that he thinks is Yom Kippur. And here, in this case, they're having a dispute about basically what time to say the prayers or, you know, the morning prayers.
Yeah, and, I think it's the evening prayers, but regardless.
The evening prayers. You know, it's important, but it's, you know, it's just one of many disputes that they have. And he basically forces Rabbi Yehoshua to stand up and he doesn't let him sit down again. And people think that's, you know, really treating him disrespectfully and unnecessarily cruelly. I'll just note one thing about the previous, that other story, because it's referred to here. The people say, like, why does he have to be torturing Rabbi Joshua just like he did last Rosh Hashanah, which basically means the story that you're referring to. And the really interesting piece, and I think there's a direct tie to the story that we've been discussing the last couple of times, the Oven of Achnai story, where Rabbi Akiva basically helps Rabbi Joshua feel okay, ultimately, about the fact that he's going to be violating what he thinks is Yom Kippur. And he reads him a verse from the Bible. And basically, there's this line that says, the basic translation is, these are the holidays that I ordain for you to observe. But there's a way of reading it where the word otam, which means them, referring to the holidays, can be read with different vowels as atem, meaning you. And there's a way to where Rabbi Akiva is doing a kind of homiletic reading here, saying to Rabbi Joshua, don't worry, God's self said, you declare the days of the holidays. And so if it turns out that Rabban Gamliel is wrong, you know, it's still back to that kind of majority rules idea. It's like there's this thing in the Torah that says majority rules, you know, don't worry about it. You declare the days of the holidays. And it doesn't really say that in the Torah. And it's another example of one of these kind of knowing, intentional misquotation winks, right, that has the effect of saying, hey, we can actually overrule the Torah. We can overrule the word of God.
based on a double, we can like double overrule it because we're overruling it using a misquotation to justify the overruling. And that's kind of how this game is played. And I guess Rabbi Joshua is kind of like, I guess that's how this game is played. It's fine. I don't think he's thrilled about it, but he's able to reconcile the situation. And that's just what's part of the backstory of this is that it's in light of, you know, it's kind of reminding us of those stories. And like you say, actually, right, I mean, in the studying process, that both that story of Rabbi Akiva and the Yom Kippur comes, you know, much later in the tractate Rosh Hashanah. And, yeah, you know, the right. story of the Oven of Achnai is in Bav Metzia much later, you know, so it's like, it just sort of relies, like you say, on, that you know these stories, even though in theory, this is the first book that you're studying.
Interestingly, you know, you're bringing up the way Rabbi Akiva misreads Torah to Rabbi Yehoshua to comfort him and get him to kind of go along with this whole Rabban Gamliel abuse. And we then find in the story of the Oven of Achnai that Rabbi Yehoshua is doing the same kind of midrashic misreading to God. You know, not that that was unusual. This was Rabbi Akiva's approach to Torah. And basically, the Talmud becomes an Akivan document. The tradition becomes an Akivan tradition, one in which that's the way we do it. And we now believe in a God who's okay with us getting it wrong as long as we take the responsibility for deciding how things should go.
So just to set the scene here, in page 27b, we're getting this. So basically what's going on here is that Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Joshua have just had a dispute. Rabban Gamliel says, you know, get up on your feet and goes on with his lecture and never tells him to sit back down. And then the other students.
It's like he tells him to stand up in the corner, you know, like a punished 10-year-old.
Yeah. And then the other people in the room, the Talmud says they started to murmur. And they told the chutzpit, in this translation, chutzpit, the disseminator. He's kind of the guy. He's like he's the amplification system. You know, Rabban Gamliel gives his lecture. Right. And then, you know, it's like we've seen this from the Middle Ages. You know, the king speaks and then somebody repeats his words louder so that people can hear it in the back of the room. You know, so they kind of, that's the way this thing is going. And they tell that guy to stop. They basically turn off. Essentially, they turn off Rabban Gamliel's mic. Right? That's the first thing they did. Right?
So yeah.
The people say, we're that's not right. going to let you do that to Rabban Gamliel, to Rabbi Joshua. And then they basically get together and say, you know, how long is this going to go on? Let's get rid of him. But before they get rid of him, they say, well, wait a second. Before we get rid of him, we got to appoint somebody else. And I don't know if you really want to get into that. I mean, they raise a variety of candidates, including Rabbi Akiva. And they say, you know, no, we can't have Rabbi Akiva, for example, because he doesn't come from a prominent enough family, specifically his family converts. And like, he doesn't have the kind of, as we say in Yiddish, yichus, you know, right. the status to be able to take a position like that, even though he's the most brilliant of the rabbis. And so they end up appointing a much younger man, a very young man whose, you know, hair isn't even white, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. You know, and he has to have like a miraculous situation where his hair turns white in order to be able to take the position. So they'd rather have a young man who descends from Ezra, the scribe, one of the great leaders of Israel. They'd rather have someone with status than someone, you know, who's the most brilliant.
And let's remember, he's not only a young man, he's 18 years old. I mean, this is a kid, a teenager. And I wonder to myself how much that makes him on the queer fringes, or, you know, they had to know that he was going to have new ideas. They had to know he was going to bring a new perspective. He was not from the old guard in the sense of his age, just because of his age. So there may be something there in terms of what we know his first act was. So that's where we jump into our story, right?
You know, that's going to be a question, right? Did they know? It sort of feels like one of those cases where, like, you know, they kind of put a new pope in for some reason, you know, and think that, oh, it's just going to caretaker, whatever, maybe John the 23rd, you know, and then he kind of, you know, upends the whole system. Did they know that was going to happen? Was that, or what, did they just miscalculate? What's going on there?
I don't know. Nobody knows. My guess is they knew exactly what they were doing, and they wanted the kind of opening up that we're about to see happens. I think so. Because this, just as the Tanur Shalach, the Oven of Achnai story, represented a kind of snapshot of the shift between us following prophecy and disregarding God's prophecy and saying, no, we're going to decide. I think this story marks the shift between one way of determining truth and a new way. And the old way is, there's debate. Okay, there for sure was debate in Rabban Gamliel's academy. But at the end of the day, what the Nasi said went. He had the right to determine how things were going to go. And that ends at this moment. And now there's a kind of infinite radical uncertainty that they adopt. So, okay, let's see how that happens.
I should note, by the way, for folks that we're intending this as a two-part series. So don't worry that we're, you know, not
making
rapid progress here. We have there's a lot of material here and we're going to cover it in two sessions. Just one last note, because I didn't know this. And when we were talking before the show, one of the interesting things is that Eleazar ben Azariah, when he's nominated, he goes and asks his wife if it's okay, which seemed to me like a kind of nice thing to do, but you explained that there was more to it than that.
Yeah. So when they ask him to be the new Nasi, the new head president, whatever, he goes and asks his wife. And the reason he asks his wife is not that he's just a nice guy. There's really a Jewish legal reason behind it. And that is that if he shifts his occupation from being a student to being the Nasi, he shifts his sort of the halachic category with regard to the frequency of sexual satisfaction he's obliged to provide for his wife. So he has to ask her, because her right to sex X number of times per week is determined by his occupation. And she had to agree to that when she agreed to marry him. Oh, I'm marrying a camel driver. Okay, I know I'm going to get it this often. Oh, I'm married to a day worker. Okay, this often, yeah, I'm going to marry this guy. And, you know, she thought she was marrying just a scholar. And now she's going to instantly be married to someone who is going to be less obligated to provide her with sex. So he needs her permission because she has to agree to reduce her sort of sexual access. And
she doesn't seem to have a huge problem with it. Maybe it's because yeah, his hair turned white and he wasn't quite as sexy as he used to be. But
there's actually more to that backstory as well, which the text does bring in. And she says to him, you know, I don't think you should do this because you may get kicked out just the way Rabban Gamliel got kicked out. This could bring you a lot of tsuris and, you know, right, heartache. He repeats this line that apparently was a common line, like here today, gone tomorrow. That it must have been something like that, which is you drink out of a glass goblet, which was very rare and valuable. You drink out of your glass goblet today, even though it might break tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So he says, yeah, okay, I'm going to drink out of that glass goblet now. Whatever happens tomorrow will happen tomorrow.
And just to note that at the very end there, there's that line that we know from the Haggadah where Rabbi Eleazar ben Azariah says, you know, I am as a man of 70 years old. And instead of saying I am 70 years old, he says I am like a man of 70 years old because he actually was 18, but he was made, his miraculous thing happened to make him look old so that he could have the status. By the way, not to talk about now, I think, but like, it's really interesting that they're so concerned about this idea of status and appearances, even though we kind of admire these folks as like the progressive, the new people. I don't know. I mean, I'm curious how that lands in our world. You know, I kind of tend to get annoyed a little bit that like people want to hear something from a rabbi, you know, these days, even though they don't really even care about rabbis, but they kind of feel it's more legitimate when it comes from a rabbi. And it's almost like if somebody is just some regular person and they can get somebody to give them rabbinical ordination, and then they can all of a sudden say, I'm a rabbi, people will somehow be satisfied by that, even though they were the same person they were yesterday. So it's like here too, it feels like this is all fake. You know, I mean, either he's a good leader or he's not a good leader. Yeah. You know, are these appearances really where we should be focused?
You know, the rabbis talk about that a lot. They talk about the role of appearance in one's ability to serve on the Sanhedrin. You know, there's a famous passage over in Sanhedrin where Rabbi Yochanan, who is famously gorgeous, says one of the requirements for serving on the Sanhedrin is to be beautiful, is to be good looking. And, you know, I think he was talking about the JFK effect, the idea that in Rashi clarifies, yeah, if you're good looking, this is super problematic. Let me just say that. But that's his claim, that if you're good looking, people will respect you and listen to you, and you'll be able to instill a sense of awe and honor. So yeah, Rabbi Eleazar has this transformation that gives him the appearance that will grant him the respect, which is odd, but yeah,
we'll come back to that too. By the way, just so that people know, I mean, classically, Rabbi Joshua is not good looking. And that's just something to note. Okay, so let's jump into the actual text that's the real first major focus of today. And we'll start, you know, doing our thing where we read and you stop me and we discuss.
Read slowly, because every line of this story is amazing. There's so much there. Okay, so let's go slow.
Okay, so it starts on, again, Brachot 28a, towards close to the top. It was taught on that day, meaning the day that Rabban Gamliel was deposed and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed instead of him, they dismissed the guard at the door and permission was granted to the students to enter.
Okay, great. I wanted to stop you mid-sentence. Okay, first of all, what is a guard doing at the door?
Right.
All right, let's first notice that there are bouncers at the doors to the Beit Midrash.
Right.
There are bouncers at the yeshiva door, guards. That's interesting.
It's really interesting.
First of all, the fact that there are doors itself is interesting, because probably in the era of Rabban Gamliel, there wasn't a kind of institutionalized academy the way we imagine a yeshiva with doors. They were probably gathering under a tree or in somebody's yard. And this whole imagination of the academy in this era was probably a retrojection from the era when the editors of the Talmud did have institutionalized yeshivot, and they're probably retrojecting this whole structure of the yeshiva back into Rabban Gamliel's time.
Right. But wait, I want to really like emphasize that only in this, I think I mentioned this maybe in a previous episode, but I really want to start thinking about this idea that I'm making the analogy to King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, that there actually was a historic, or people, you know, literary scholars think there actually was a historic Arthur. He wasn't a king of the United Kingdom of England, you know, and he wasn't from the Middle Ages. He was probably some tribal chieftain type of person in the, long, long before the Middle Ages. And there were these stories about him and how, what an amazing, you know, person he was and all that. And then subsequent, every generation would kind of retell the story of Arthur. And once there started to be kings of England, Britain, whatever, you know, then he became a king. And, you know, then he started to get knights of the round table. And then these knights, initially, maybe they had some kind of historical connection to different parts of Britain that were coming together. But then over time, they started to get a character. So Lancelot is the gallant, you know, one and, you know, whatever. And so when we look at the stories of Arthur, we're actually seeing layer upon layer. You can excavate and do archaeology on the story itself and learn things. And so the setting in the world of the Middle Ages with knights and shields and horses, like that tells us more about the people writing in the Middle Ages than it tells us about Arthur. Yet, there are also things that we can dig into the story and try to find some of the real sort of deeper nuggets that kind of have the sense of ancient wisdom. And those may well be the most ancient things. And so it's really interesting to note that probably maybe there was some issue going on at the time that the story was composed much later that had to do with kind of who was going to be allowed to study in the yeshiva.
That's right.
You know, it's like if Harvard's talking about, like, should we expand our class size? You know, they might say, well, back in the day, in the early days of Harvard, they actually had this conversation and they decided not to expand it. You know, right?
That's right.
You know, and that story was kind of true. It had there's something like that happened. And so that's kind of what one of the pieces that's going on here. And so I think it's actually valuable to always be thinking at least at two different time scales, right? One, what do we think might have been going on in those early days after the temple was destroyed? And the other, what's happening some hundreds of years later that might have been an active issue that they, like we do in the Supreme Court today, trying to find some originalist argument that strengthens their hand.
That's right. So this really is a story of 500 years later, somewhere in the 5th, 6th century, that is being set. It's a struggle that's being fought out with a story being set 500 years prior during the era of the Rat Pact or the era of the greats or the original. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And it's, by the way, it's a little hard to... Sorry, I keep interrupting
you now. No, go ahead.
But it's a little hard to like even struggle with that part of it because like, so far, we've talked to two historians of the Talmud, and it's really hard to get a good read on what was happening at that later time, or especially that kind of middle time of the composition of the Talmud, you know, maybe the 4th century, the 5th century. It's hard to quite wrap my mind around what life was like then and what people might have been trying to get at. And it really, I think it's kind of important if it's possible to discover that, because it's like, I'm thinking today, right? Harvard may well be thinking about expanding its class size, because in the COVID period, all of a sudden now we're seeing that we can have online education and that it could really be effective and whatever. And Harvard might say, hey, why not expand our class size 5 times as big? We'll get more money. We'll, you know, outcompete some of these other schools and whatever. And so that question about like that story of, you know, back in 1636, you know, there was an attempt to do, right? That really is a live issue, but it's a live issue for a very particular reason, which we've just gone through this pandemic. So yes. I really, really makes me wonder, like, what happened in the year 400 that was making some issue happening, you know? And maybe that matters in a way that it feels like we don't know, I don't know enough about that time.
Yeah. Critical Talmud scholarship is now almost completely focused on that question. Mm. The layer of the stama, which has only been in our own lifetimes discovered or identified. Oh, one final okay. thing. I think a lot about rabbinic education. And this story is a very personal one for me, because in order for me to go to rabbinical school, you know, there were guards at the doors, essentially, right. that said, you know, you have to be straight. You have to pass the straight test. And I snuck around the guards at the door. And rabbinic education still, even though every rabbinical school in the liberal world accepts LGBTQ students, there are all sorts of other tests and sort of litmus tests and requirements beyond, you know, how much Hebrew you know, that have to do with your politics and, you know, what you think about Israel and whether you're willing to go there or not and whom you're dating and who you're married to. And there are all sorts of guards still at the door. And I think, you know, it's a very live question for rabbis today. Like, you know, who's being let in to the academy?
Absolutely. And one other point to make about that is that this is set, at least it's set, in the early days of rabbinic education. Before that, there might have been, you know, imagine like a priest school. Now, priests, to become a priest was not a matter of education, but you could imagine maybe there were like the superstar priests could learn to do the sacrifices and things. The other priests were kind of helpers, you know, whatever. And so to get into like higher priest school, you had to have certain criteria. And we know from the Torah that some of those involved things like sexual orientation, not that was a criterion in the priest, but like things like your body had to be a certain way. And that there were certain criteria about how your body was to know whether you could really be a functioning priest. And so here was the setting up of a post-priest school, right? It happened to be called a rabbinical school. I mean, you know, now we would call it a rabbinical school. But in a way, it's the analogy to, in our time, if we would imagine a post-rabbinical school, you know, like this is the school that's training the next type of leader. And that's right. One of the questions is, are we going to make the same mistakes that the previous kind made? You know, so maybe we're just starting to see that rabbinical schools are starting, for example, started some years ago to many, not all rabbinical schools, of course, but many, at least liberal Judaism rabbinical schools admit people without regard to sexual orientation, for example. That's wonderful. As we set up a post-rabbinical school, let's say, is that the starting point? Like, we just want to, you know, certainly we don't want to backtrack, but no, I mean, shouldn't we blow it even further and say, like, there's all these categories that you still can't get into rabbinical school. In the post-rabbinical school, for sure, those, you know, which of those are going to be wiped away? And that's what's going on here, right?
Absolutely. And beside the LGBTQ, Israel, Zionism, intermarriage issue, it's well known that the dean who accepted me and my classmates in my era, who, I don't want to use the word deposed, but who left, the next dean, everyone said those people who were accepted before would never have been accepted. Not because we were queer or this and that, but because we were seekers. We were newly observant. You know, the first day of rabbinical school was the first day we kept kosher or kept Shabbos for many of us. And we were sort of trying things out. We were seekers. And once this dean left, the new dean put new guards at the door, and you had to be already have had a long track of being observant, and you know, you had to be already be there. This is going on right now. And one of the questions is, what's the purpose of the academy? Is it a professional school? Is it formative? Okay. Yep. We'll get into the
okay.
story.
Let's go back. By the way, anybody who thinks we're going this too slowly, I just want to tell them that like this is the fast version.
So where are we? So there are guards at the door, and the first act of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah as the new head is to fire the guards at the door.
Right. And then the Talmud explains, because Rabban Gamliel,
Okay, the wait, I just want to get to the second half of that sentence. The guards are fired and permission is given to anyone who wants to learn. Okay, so all of a sudden there are no criteria, no quote unquote guards at the door.
Right. No admissions requirements.
No admissions requirement. The only thing you have to do is to want to learn. That's it. Anyone who wants to learn can now come and learn. That's cool. That's interesting. Okay, got it.
Well, and then it explains what the previous admissions requirements had been.
Right.
Because it says, because Rabban Gamliel would proclaim and say, any student whose inside is not like his outside will not enter the study hall.
Okay,
so
let's,
I don't know if we have to get into that too deeply, but what does that mean? What are those admission requirements?
Yeah, so this line always vexes me. I'm not sure what to do with it. On its face, it looks like a really reasonable requirement. It seems nice. Your insides have to be like your outsides. It seems to mean something like you have to have a kind of integrity. Your, like, who you are as a person has to match the way you walk through the world. You have to manifest who you really are. There can't be a discrepancy or disparity between who you purport to be and who people think you are and who you really are. That seems like a good thing. Or is it a bad thing? Is it that we're going to judge who you really are based on your manners or your demeanor? Is it sort of a classist overlay where people are being misjudged as to what's inside?
I mean, the part that appeals to me about it, I think, is like, I think about, let's say, classically in the Ivy League, maybe today still to some extent, certainly 50 years ago, there was this notion of these Brahmin families who looked really, you know, like the Kennedys and, you know, looked really great and were good at rowing crew and, you know, but they might not have been very smart or very nice or thoughtful. And part of me feels like Rabban Gamliel is saying, like, those people wouldn't get into my yeshiva, to my school, because their inside is rotten or insufficient, at least, and their outside is maybe beautiful. So that's a good thing. But then it feels to me like the bad thing is that there are all these people, like, for example, Rabbi Joshua, who might be so wonderful on the inside, but not good looking or somehow otherwise impressive on the outside. Rabbi Akiva, we know some about his looks from the Talmud, but we know that the way that his outside was problematic is that he didn't have the pedigree, the status. Now they got in, I mean, however they got in, whatever, but it seems like a lot of people wouldn't get in that are kind of, oh, that person is a simpleton, a farmer, a dirty, doesn't shower, you know, doesn't smell good, whatever, you know, whatever that might be. And even though they might be a brilliant person, that's what always struck me as the problematic part of that way of thinking.
Or is the problematic part that who do these guards think they are to be able to ascertain whether someone's insides match their outside? Is it the sort of the hubris and the obvious inability and inaccuracy of such a test? Is it the fact that there's a test at all? Is it a bad test? I'm not sure.
I don't
know what to make of this, but having done a little research on this sugi as well, this statement that is put into the mouth of Rabban Gamliel, the test that one's inside should be like one's outside, was a much later utterance by Rava, one of our heroes. And in the Palestinian version of the story, this line doesn't appear at all. So I'm not sure what it adds to the story to put this here. You know, it seems like the original story didn't name the criterion at all, just that there were guards. I'm not sure what to make of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So Rava, supposedly, that was his position, or that he was against that position?
No, Rava believed that. Rava said a bunch of things about what it looks like to be a good student of Torah. You know, what's the right way to learn? Uh-huh. But not that he used these as criteria for admissions or for... So this sort of slogan that he had is put into the mouth of Rabban Gamliel as a test.
I think we should, like, as you say, put a sticky on this question. But it would be interesting if in some ways this is actually a story of Rava's yeshiva, and that maybe Rava did have that test and eventually came to see that it wasn't right to have it as a test. And that would be a kind of, you know, interesting little story. But the one thing that I wanted to add about the specific criteria, maybe I have, you know, college admissions on the mind because I have a high school junior, you know, but when you hear college admissions officers, they often will say something like, you know, I could admit a completely different class of 2,000 people or 1,500 people and it would be equally good. And they're saying that is kind of like, oh, you shouldn't feel so bad if you weren't admitted because there's some randomness in the system, right? But what happens is that the kid who wasn't admitted is really sad and devastated, you know, and I'm not sure that that's so, such a comforting type of thing. And what I'm feeling a little bit is like, well, why not admit all the people that you could admit, you know, that would be suitable for your school. And then they'll say, of course, we don't have enough dorms. We don't have enough, you know, or maybe it would hurt our brand if we had more people. But in the post-COVID time, I wonder how persuasive that's going to be, because we're starting to see, well, you can do online learning. It's not as good, but it's not that bad. And maybe with a little bit more time and effort and the technology develops, like maybe there are ways to actually admit everybody to this prestigious school that actually kind of deserves it. And maybe that would create a lot more equity in terms of racial justice and in terms of economic justice. And it wouldn't have to be that expensive because it would be online. And maybe that's just an option. And it's, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities. And the question is whether these folks are going to take those possibilities. And there may be legitimate reasons not to. But at some point, I think the test is going to be, look, are you really motivated by real limitations, like how many dorms you have? Or are you really motivated by the desire to keep your brand value in a certain way? And I'm not sure that I can really get behind that. Like, I'm not sure that that's worthy of accepting when the world has just changed and been turned upside down in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. I think that's what's happening with Rabban Gamliel. It looks like okay, maybe this is why they put that line in there in his mouth, because his stance is, you know, remember when he talks back to God on the ship in the Yavon Avachnai story? Hey, don't blame me for hurting Rabbi Eliezer. Oh, I did this only so that there wouldn't be disputes in Israel, so that we would maintain unity. That's all I'm about. And, you know, here he's saying, I have good reason. And I think it could be that what the story is bringing out is he's hiding a kind of fear-driven distrust, control motive behind this apparent, oh, I have good intentions. It's important that every student be a certain kind of student. I don't know. There's something there. I think you're right.
Okay, so let's jump back into the text and see what happens once they do this, once they remove the guards from the door and remove the admissions requirement. So the next line is, on that day, several benches were added to the study hall. And of course, in good Talmudic fashion, there's now a dispute about how many benches. Rabbi Yochanan said, Abba Yosef ben Dostai and the rabbis disputed this matter. One said 400 benches were added to the study hall, and one said 700 benches were added to the study hall. Bottom line, a lot of benches were added to the study hall.
Okay, so a couple of things come up for me. One is you can't see this dispute about was it 400, was it 700, without thinking about the last story we learned, I think, where the carob tree moves across the courtyard, and the only thing they're disputing is how far did the carob tree move? Was it this many cubits or that many cubits? Nobody disputes that the carob tree miraculously moved. And also, when you're talking about colleges and access and the era of COVID and online learning, these benches, we're talking about access here. And all these benches, I don't know, the benches came to mind when you were talking about the, you know, the possibilities now for greater reach. There's an unlimited number of benches we can now put in the Beit Midrash.
Oh, right. That's fascinating. The thing that has always struck me about this line, this fact, right? I mean, the point, right? It's like, you could say, hey, we took the guards off the door, we released the admissions requirements, and a couple of guys wandered in, you know, right? There were a couple of people loitering out there. No, what's described here is that there was a flood of people. And I love the idea that you could argue, right? And I mean, this goes back to what I'm saying about these college admissions officers. They could argue they didn't have enough dorm space, but now they basically have unlimited space. So now the question is, am I willing to let the people in? Am I, you know, what else, what's driving me to not let them in, really? And what I really love about this line is that it really strikes me that it resonates with a lot of things that are said in our time Jewishly today, where people say, oh, you know, they're not interested in Judaism. The people, they're disengaged. Yeah. I mean, they're not interested. Yeah. It's like, no, they're not interested in it the way you're insisting it has to be. That is true. So if you're saying that I insist that it has to be a certain way, then yeah, they're not interested. But as soon as you say, well, maybe it doesn't have to be the way that I insisted that it's going to be, in this case, that the insides have to match the outsides. But in another case, it could be, you know, that you must observe halakha in a certain way, or you must, you know, you can't be queer, you know, to come in or whatever. As soon as you say, oh, you know what, that was a mistake, I'm taking that criterion away, there's a flood of people. And so there's this pent up demand, right, that it's just desperate for a release to be allowed in. And it just seems like that's not the typical way that demographers and all the people that study the Jewish community, they're saying, like, how many times a week do you light Shabbat candles, right? Or I guess that's one, but they're saying, you know, how are you lighting Shabbat candles on Shabbat? But instead, but what if they asked, what if we said you didn't have to light Shabbat candles in order to be a good Jew? Maybe we would have a huge flood of Jews coming in. You know, that's a stupid example, but that's illustrative of the point.
Absolutely. This moment so, like, grabs my heart, because what's not said in the text, but as a person who wasn't let in, I feel the suffering. I feel what happened to those students before this line, like what they were feeling not being able to be let in, and the drama of what it must have been like for them to finally be let in. And oh my God, I now have access to Torah.
Yeah.
I remember it was a book by Art Waskow, and he said something about we were all at Mount Sinai. And I thought, oh my God, we were all at Mount Sinai? We all got the Torah? And this rabbinical school isn't giving me access to the Torah? Mm. I'm like, F them! Like, it's not theirs. It's mine.
Right.
It's always been mine. And that's what these students were feeling. And finally, you know, someone is saying, yeah, it's always been yours. Come get it.
When you tell your story about how you, you've said, like, I went into the closet for 5 years, or I don't know, it was 6 years to in order to, like, get the Torah so that I could bring it to other queer folk. I hear that as a story of Prometheus, right? Stealing fire from the gods. And you can think of the story of Prometheus as this clever, you know, man who stole fire from the gods. But the real story is, like, why were the gods taking the fire away from the people? Like, what was up with that? And I kind of feel like, you know, it's a tragedy that there has to be a Prometheus. You know, it's a tragedy that there has to be these kind of rebels who have to go in and steal the plans to the Death Star. You know, right? I mean, like, I guess in that case. But, you know, but I think of it the same way. You know, like, I feel like I don't have the same kind of identifiable folk as you, you know, and saying, like, there's queer folk and they've been explicitly kept out of Jewish institutions. And so I went and stole the Torah to bring to them. But that was very much my story as well. You know, I felt that I grew up in an environment, in a Jewish world that I didn't believe in, a more religious, traditionally religious world. And it wasn't for me. And if that was the only choice that I was being offered, then they would have said, oh, he's not interested. I remember I thought that about myself. Like, I had a conversation with the rabbi of the school that I went to, the high school that I went to, an Orthodox high school in Israel. And he said to me, like, late in senior year, he was doing exit interviews with all the students. And he said, you know, I know you're going to college in America. I hope that you'll find someone to study with who wants to study as much as you, something like that. And I was like, you know, that'll be easy, because I didn't want to study at all. And so I would easily find someone who wanted to study as much as me, which was zero. But in retrospect, I'm like, yeah, but that's because the only version that I was presented was this one version. I wasn't interested in that. But obviously, it turns out I'm very interested in the material of Judaism. And so I'm not sure exactly how to define my folks, but I kind of feel like I'm trying to be the you for those folks, you know, and say, this belongs to us. And, you know, that there are barriers being put up there that say you're not a good Jew if you don't do it our way. But as soon as those barriers come down, there's actually a huge interest. And then the question is, like, hey, what do you do with that? What does that produce?
And let's acknowledge that it's scary to someone who loves something that's this way. These guys had an idea, and the new Judaism they were creating, you know, was their little baby. And I think they were afraid. It was such a little seedling. They were afraid to open it up so big, because I think they didn't trust. That trust is a very big issue, trust between one generation and the next. And I think when things are changing quickly, the impulse is to only let in the few who think the way you do, when actually the better impulse, which is counterintuitive for us, is to let the maximal number of people in to take care of this little baby plant.
What's making me think of is two things, the way you just put it. One is that to remember that, to keep reminding myself. I mean, you said it, but to remember that this story is set at the dawn of the new thing, meaning it's not a story about Harvard expanding the size of its class, actually. It's about the startup competitor to Harvard saying, like, how many criteria for admission are we going to have? You know, and that's important because if you set it up as it's the new fighting against the old, that's one kind of setup. But it's actually, and this goes back to what we were talking about with the Oven of Achnai story, that is actually a dispute between the new and the new. And it's an internal dispute. And that's making me think, too, about, like, and we've talked about this, you know, offline in all kinds of ways about our own projects. And sometimes for me, it's actually less about, do I want to invite in the more radical folks? I totally do. But I kind of think about, like, how far am I interested in inviting in the more traditional folks to my, whether it's Jewish Live or Judaism Unbound or whatever sort of project this is that's about charting that course to the third era. And sometimes my impulse is like, well, they're more interested in the second year. And I feel like I have to be like more generous about that in terms of this story, that it's not only maybe that when they remove the guards at the door that the radicals come in, maybe also a bunch more conservatives come in.
Yeah, we're going to see that, right? And I think that's going to happen. You know, what I said about this being a baby academy, I'm really only thinking this out now that, you know, I wonder if this early learning place was more of a sustaining innovation. I'm not sure, but it adopted some of the guards at the door mentality of the old and hadn't yet been radically democratized. We see a democratization from hereditary priesthood to any person, but not yet anyone who wants. And I think there's, maybe it's speaking to the danger in the early phases of something new that you want to protect. I'm not sure.
So we're towards the end of our time. So I don't want to just end this on a complete cliffhanger. I want to give one more line and then understand that we're going to go back into it next time into more details. We're going to even backtrack a little bit into things we've just discussed, but also we're going to go forward. But I want to close this on just the note that there is a line that comes just a few lines later, and we're going to go back so that we don't skip the lines in between. But there's a line that says that on that day, there was no halakha, meaning no dispute, no law, no practice, no question of practice that was pending in the study hall that day that they did not explain, meaning that the Talmud story has as a very central point that it's sort of hammering that it wasn't only that they invited in this expanded group. It was that the inviting in of the expanded group let them solve all the problems. Meaning, like, it was like, what would have happened if we hadn't admitted these people? It's not just that we wouldn't have been nice. It's that we wouldn't have even had a Judaism, meaning that everything would still be chaotic. Somehow the inviting in of these people made it work, made it solved,
Yeah, that line is... it just gets me that all of those unresolved dilemmas and issues that had been just hanging, and in the Hebrew term is just hanging, literally, tuluya, all of a sudden, because all these people came in, were solved. They were all resolved. The insights of those who were sort of on the margins and seemed unworthy were precisely the things that were the insights that were necessary to resolve the problem. It's just stunning. And you're right. It's not only to benefit the students, the poor students who couldn't learn Torah. It was to benefit the tradition who needed them. And they didn't realize until they let them in, although the new guard realizes, presumably, or maybe they didn't. Maybe they didn't realize what this was going to do. And now all of a sudden they realize, oh my God, this is what we needed to understand things that were vexing us.
Yeah. My impulse is that they didn't realize and they learned it through this is, you know, what I think I said a few times, they learned it from the experience. And the reason why we have this story is because they were trying to tell us that that's what happens. You know, they're trying to tell us, don't make the same mistake that we did, you know, let everybody in and because that's what's going to get you where you're trying to go. So I think that we'll pick it up next time. It gets even more radical. So it's an incredible story. I think it's so important. And I can't wait to keep talking about it with you, Vinay.
Me too. All right.
All right.
Thanks, Dan.
So we'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks so much for being part of our Chavruta today. We hope you've enjoyed learning with us and with the Talmud. You can find links to the source sheets for all of our episodes in the show notes and on our website at oraltalmud.com. Your financial support helps keep the Oral Talmud going. You can find a link on our website to make a contribution. We'd also love to hear from you. Email us with any questions, comments, or thoughts at hello@oraltalmud.com. Please share your Oral Talmud with us. We're so excited to learn from you. The Oral Talmud is a joint project of Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva, and Judaism Unbound, two organizations that are dedicated to making Jewish texts and ideas more accessible for everyone. We're especially grateful to Sepharia for an incredible platform that makes the Talmud available to everyone. It's free at sepharia.org. And we're grateful to Svaranik Ezra Furman for composing and performing the Oral Talmud's musical theme. The Oral Talmud is produced by Joey Taylor with help from Olivia Dvorah Tucker and with financial support from Lippman Kamfer Foundation for Living Torah. Thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been The Oral Talmud. See you next time.